This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Thank you to Dr. Conti and the rest of the committee for inviting me to present some of the Kaiser data and talk about more data than pictures in this one. I have no disclosures. So as I thought about this topic, you know, I really asked myself, what is there to be gained with EVAR research this year and beyond? I have this sense that practice habits are pretty deeply entrenched, especially with more and more EVAR experience. For example, is the open versus EVAR question already answered for most people, at least on an individual surgeon level? We all have our biases, and we practice that way. The latest data would tell us from circulation that over 75% of intact elective AAA repairs are now done EVAR. Part of this issue is that there's just a lot of data out there. If you look in the top right corner of PubMed and you Google or you search EVAR or endovascular aneurysm repair, you get this kind of graph. And what you see here is in 1999, there were two publications, and you go to fast forward to 2016, there are 358 publications about endovascular AAA repair. And so there's information overload. There's lots of randomized data, which I'll touch on briefly, the OVERTrial, EVAR-1, EVAR-2, DREAM, and there's plenty of registry data, of which, you know, I would throw the Kaiser data in there as well. Administrative, industry, all the Scandinavian countries, which have great population-based data, and then obviously VQI. So then what do we want to know? I mean, what really will drive practice? Is it about patient selection? Is it about device selection? Or is it about the surgeons that are actually performing the procedures? And so then how can we use the data? For me, I think it would be more about benchmarking for our integrated healthcare system. And then finally, really monitoring the devices over time. As we've been hearing all morning, they tend to fail. This is kind of a busy slide touching on the differences between randomized controlled trials and registries. You all know this, and I would just sum it up by saying, you know, a well-done randomized trial has high internal validity, but what you also want to look for is external validity, which is what you can get with a large or diverse registry. So the registries for evidence-based medicine, they're really ideal when you want some real-world applicability and you need large sample sizes to detect rare events like device failure, and you need longitudinal follow-up, which EVAR, it's critical, and also where RCTs are not practical or feasible. So for the purposes of today's talk and, you know, what we usually look at Kaiser are benchmarking. How do we compare with the published results? And do we have any device durability concerns, and can we pivot in our registry analysis to look at those devices, the difference being a retrospective study versus some proactive or prospective monitoring protocols. So maybe some of the best data that's come out recently from the EVAR-1 trial, it looks at their long-term data. As you all know, they recruited between 1999 and 2004 and had about 600 patients that were randomized to EVAR. And they followed out to 15 years, and that was their latest publication, showing an 83% freedom from aneurysm-related mortality, so ARM, you'll see that throughout the slides, at 15 years, which, in my opinion, is quite good. You also have various industry registries, and they're here today, the Engage registry is in a Medtronic Endurant registry. So again, it's a single device, but it's quite comprehensive. Lots of patients they've captured throughout a lot of countries. The GREAT registry, in quotes, because that's the name of it, it's not what I think of it, and shows really good freedom from aneurysm-related mortality with the GORE device, again, in multiple countries with lots of patients. So as we started to look at our data, and we focused on the 10-year period of when we started, you can see that the prevalence or the use of EVAR increased over time. And then I can tell you that the 2011 to current has continued this upward increase. You know, if you look over here, there are very few EVARs done in the year 2000, pretty much done by Tim and Steve O'Kuhn sitting over there. And then as we gained experience and recruited surgeons who could do more, we became probably like everyone else, more willing to use it and more aggressive with our indication. So this is our first paper that we basically summarized this multi-center registry data. Although it was 10-year results, you know, because a lot of the EVARs were backloaded in the last half of that time period, you know, astute readers and reviewers pointed out that the follow-up, mean follow-up, was really only about three and a half years. So what did we do? We found a hardworking resident and made her look at the charts again. And she actually is a UCSF resident. So we added 5 years to this cohort. So the first thing we want to do is benchmark our all-cause mortality, which is a very similar curve if you look at, the EVAR-1 long-term data. You know, I'm a visual person, and they basically look the same if you adjust for the scale. Similarly, aneurysm-related mortality is pretty good. It was in the high 80s at out to 15 years. And if you look at the, this is the same curve over here in green. It looks actually very similar, and the data is similar. Now, one of the observations about the EVAR-1 trial is that they were all, a lot of them were first-generation devices. Again, you know, it was recruiting 1999 to 2003. And so there's this thought that, you know, the older devices and the older techniques and indications and experience, frankly, led to maybe worse outcomes versus the, you know, the newer generation of devices and surgeons. So are the more recent repairs or the devices, are they better? There's a couple of papers out there about that. The biggest series is from Professor Verzini, published in 2014. And so he designated the old stent grafts as 1997 to 2003 with 500 patients, and the new from 2004 to 2011. They obviously had different mean follow-ups, but they had enough patients to do survival curves comparing them. And so what you see there is fairly similar, non-significant curves for survival and aneurysm-related mortality. So we decided, as some of the flex of the registry, to look at this question as well. And we have, our early group is essentially split down the middle. And similarly, we had more repairs in the later stage group, and each had their own five-year follow-up. The main difference is demographically, and again, without the anatomic descriptions of the aneurysms, there were a lot more urgent indications and more women. And then there were more statin use, and I think that was just reflected the medical care and more people with hypertension. And what we found was similarly, although those curves diverge, they don't diverge in a significant way, and that's all-cause mortality. And that was reflected also in a recent VQI presentation at the SVS last year when they looked at a very early cohort versus a very contemporary cohort. And when you look at aneurysm-related mortality, comparing the early versus late, you see that there's no difference. Now, the Italian paper noted that there is more reinterventions in the early group, as you can see in this curve here. When we looked at our data, we found that there was really no difference in adverse event rates, endoleaks type 1 or 3, or major reinterventions out to 5 years in each group. And the way I maybe might think of this data is that we are doing perhaps more urgent patients, perhaps the anatomy might be more challenging, but based on some unknown component of experience and maybe improved vices, our outcomes are similar. As we transitioned from 2010 to 2011, our regional registry was phased out and it was folded into the National Endovascular Stent Registry at Kaiser, which has taken over following these devices. And they currently, you know, in Northern California, we do anywhere from 200 to 300 EVARs a year, which are captured. Southern California is a similar number. And then the other regions as well report. So, you know, as of 2014, they're following 3,000 total EVARs. So it's part of a actually very large registry that tracks all orthopedic implants, which are there are hundreds of thousands, and cardiology type devices, including pacemakers, valves, et cetera. They have industry and our own Kaiser money pooled into looking at these outcomes. They track reintervention, readmission, and index complications. One of the nice components about this registry is that it's semi-automated, so that if you're a surgeon and you do an EVAR, you actually can't get away from the computer without filling out an online form about your case, which all gets captured. One of the ways that we've been using this, because it's only been tracking data since 2010, and maybe the outcomes are not quite mature enough yet to report, we do use it for device safety evaluation. And I'm sure you've all seen the safety notice that went out at the end of 2016, which was on top of other device safety warnings about this particular model. And so we were experiencing some issues related to that, and we were able to pull, as you can see here, reintervention rates by device. And again, it doesn't really specify what the anatomy was, what the experience of the surgeon was, or even what the indication was, but it gives you the crude rates of reintervention based on the type of device. So it enables us to quickly look at, well, which devices require more reintervention or more resources. More recently, we were able to more granularly pull out the actual cases of type 3 leaks with this device. And as you know, there have been 3A and 3B issues, which we are closely monitoring. We're working with the company to report these. But more importantly, I think, you know, we've put in close to 600 of these nationally, and only a small portion have we've uncovered with the reinterventions and the late ruptures. But we're trying to formulate an algorithm where how do we more aggressively surveil these patients? How do we catch them before they become an issue? And that's just one example of what this can do. So in conclusion, I think that the long-term freedom from aneurysm-related mortality after EVAR, even long-term, is favorable in our real-world data, and it kind of mimics the randomized data. I also believe that EVAR is here to stay. Therefore, ongoing VQI and registry data like that, it's necessary for benchmarking QA and for monitoring these devices. The last thing I would say is that you know, we were a little late to the game with VQI, but I think we're looking forward to maybe end of 2017-18 kind of partnering with MedStreaming to coordinate all of the things I just talked about into one big database. Thank you very much.
That was great. If there's any questions, I guess while people are thinking of questions, I have one. So I think that was terrific and really important information to be able, in such a large number of patients, be able to track outcomes of specific devices. Question I have for you is, do you have information in your database as to whether or not patients were on or off IFU? Because that would be really valuable stuff to link with that in terms of looking at outcomes.
I think we presented something at the Western a few years ago, and I think Dr. Conti asked that question, and it made us look at that. And the reality is we don't. And Dr. Quinones-Baldrich cited that paper that we're only able to look at a smaller portion that had orthogonal images that you could actually measure the anatomy. And it's a little it's unfortunate, but we don't really know.
And that may be some of the value in linking with VQI, because VQI does collect some anatomic information.
I mean, for the last 6 or 7 years, we do have that data. But going back historically and looking at long-term outcomes and correlating them with neck length and all of that, I'd love to report that. It's hard.
I have a question. Bobby, that was a great talk. We had a quality organization called VI Scope in the Pacific Northwest, and it had been going on for a decade, and we were very reluctant to partner with VQI. And now we have. As of 3 years ago, we started entering our data into VQI, and part of the stumbling blocks of merging that data was two different reporting systems, and it wasn't just the data, but it was the software. And I'm wondering, what are your stumbling blocks for combining the Kaiser data with the VQI data? And what do you foresee as, you know, getting through that?
From my own anecdotal experience, we met with M2S early on in the phase before VQI had rolled out, and honestly, the leadership just wasn't quite ready. You know, they were just embracing NISQIP and investing in another system. They didn't really see the value. They do now, and we had already made some investments in these other registries, but I think I can probably say that we have signed a contract with Medstreaming, and we are going to revamp our whole imaging system. So all ultrasound and imaging reports are going to go funnel through there, and eventually all of the surgeon kind of workflow will funnel through there. So we're hoping to semi-automate it, because as you know, one of the biggest obstacles to collecting data is having a surgeon actually participate in that. So, you know, trying to take them out of the process will help.
One final question I have is, these databases are only as good as the follow-up, and I think Kaiser may have some unique capability of having a more captive population for follow-up, but, you know, how are you doing with follow-up, and is there anything unique that you're doing? I mean, we thought that we're great, we follow all our patients and everything. When we actually looked at what our follow-up percentage was in VQI, I mean, we struggle to keep it 80% with patients that come from far away and things for repair, but how are you doing that at Kaiser, and what is your follow-up percentage?
It's actually really good. I think there is always an attrition rate of people losing membership or moving out of the area or just refusing follow-up, but if you take those people aside, it's almost 100%. If you incorporate these people, it's 92%. And so at the end, when they die, we know, you know, what their stent has done, how big their AAA is, how many reinterventions they've had. I think that's a strength of the registry. I think that combining that with, you know, Dr. O'Kuhn, when he was at Kaiser, basically spearheaded the surveillance of smaller aneurysms. So between surveilling the 18 to 20,000 people in Northern California with smaller aneurysms, and then if those that move on to repair get repair, and then we follow them longitudinally, I think we're developing a very good picture of sort of the natural history of this problem.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.